Ian Cameron, man, I just like this guy. And I think pretty much anybody who's met him does as well. He spent years running Action Society's Farm Safety and Crime Response Networks, and he gained national prominence for taking on the former Man in the Hat police minister. You remember him? Bheki Cele. And then the Democratic Alliance came calling. And since 2024, he's become this very famous, important politician. I hope he hasn't lost his humility. I don't think so. He's now chairing the Portfolio Committee on Police. That's like a big job. Those portfolio committees, as you might have seen in the coverage that we've had lately on the Madlanga Commission and elsewhere, are very, very important organizations for our accountability here in South Africa. It's the body that grilled the National Commissioner on Accountability and pushed for the suspension of a Major General over corruption concerns. So Ian no longer is frustrated by just telling me what the problems are. He can now do something about it. Under his watch, the committee has flagged the capacity crisis in crime intelligence and detective services and pushed through the re-enlistment of 62 detectives in the Western Cape alone. He'll tell you, you don't have detectives, you don't have convictions. He was with us the last time we were here in the Drakensberg. And I remember we had a fabulous trip back home. Jeanette and I drove to the airport with Ian, the three of us in our car. And I think we forged a really good relationship there, Ian. Like me, believes, you know, we're all here to serve a much higher purpose. And I think you see that in the way that he goes about his incredibly important role for our country. Let's welcome Ian Cameron.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, South Africa's leading boutique wealth manager, trusted to guide families for over 22 years. Invest better with Brenthurst.
So Alex says, I no longer have to share the frustration just with you, but now I can, it's actually, I now share the frustration with them and you. I won't forget that previous trip when we drove back from here to Durban. I actually said to my dad afterwards, it felt like I was driving with my parents because I was sitting between the, you make it look like a bad thing. I meant it as a compliment. I felt like I was sitting between the two seats chatting to my mom and dad. And it's good to learn from you and Jeanette, Alec. It's such a pleasure. I have to talk about rebuilding SAPS. And if I have to do more 10-point plans or 15-point plans and so on, it becomes mind-numbing after a while. But I said, what are the foundational aspects that we need to try and turn this thing around? Things have really gotten extremely ugly. You see what happens on the Madlanga Commission, people that have been arrested this morning, a very prominent ex-cop / business, alleged business person, et cetera, was arrested in Durban that had previously been investigated for human trafficking, amongst other things. Very prominent and close to the previous police minister, Bheki Cele. And so the news keeps running. Before I share what those foundational principles are, I want to run through with you where we are at the moment, what we are finding, what our experience is, and just share a few short stories with you. Earlier this year, we did a test from Parliament where we phoned 1,025 police stations across the country. And of those, 571 did not answer. So more than 50% did not answer the phone. Now, it's important to give you some context that those aren't emergency numbers. So it's not 1-0-111. I know that's a challenge on its own. But these are the ordinary numbers that people use to contact their local police stations and to follow up on cases, check, you know, what's happening with something. And it's basically to get hold of just normal administrative services at the police station. So what happens when this number isn't answered? It's obviously not the biggest policing problem, I get that, but it speaks on behalf of something so much bigger, because if we can't get that basic thing right, that's why we know how bad it's going with detectives, with vehicle management, forensics, intelligence, just general management, for goodness sake. And that's why over the past 2 years as chair of the Police Portfolio Committee, I've really tried my best to visit as many police stations and ground level units as I possibly can. Now, obviously, my constituency is in Cape Town, so it would logically mean that I visit more of them in Cape Town. But we visited stations here in KZN, a lot in Gauteng, done Northwest, Free State, Northern Cape, every province actually so far. And a few examples was that, you know, a few examples of how the mismatch is between national and local was that many times SAPS management would tell us one thing, but when we visit the station, we find something totally, totally different. Few examples. Recently, I visited the Cape Town Flying Squad, and they had less than 40% vehicle strength. Visited Nelson Mandela Bay Flying Squad. They have one double cab bucky. They call themselves the Dying Squad. Then there's the DNA backlog. At the moment, after a parliamentary question, we learned that there's a total of 298,000 DNA exhibits entries that are currently on hand, with 228,000 that are already beyond the prescribed processing period. So the backlog is over 300,000 cases, put simply, and it basically means the difference between quickly potentially putting a rapist behind bars or not. Now, you can imagine in a country with a crisis like we do with sexual offenses and violence against women and children, what a risk and threat this further poses to people. The story I always share, and I've actually shared it on a BizNews platform, was the story of Chantal Mokoena in Rocklands in the Eastern Cape, 4-year-old little girl, raped, mutilated, dumped in a pit toilet, and the perpetrator continued to do what he did because the DNA processing took almost 2 years for him to eventually be arrested and then prosecuted accordingly. Now, this is all happening while SAPS has a total of 722 brigadiers and generals, 578 brigadiers to be exact. We've got 123 major generals. We've got 20 lieutenant generals and obviously the national commissioner, which is the only so-called full general. The organization has a budget of about 127 billion rand per year, with more than 102 billion going on compensation. And I'm obviously not saying, I mean, chat to Rory, for example, I'm not saying we don't need generals and officers and people need to be paid. We get that. The question that we're asking is, are the right people in the right ranks and are we getting return on investment? And at the moment, I think we all know what the answer is. Now, the problem becomes, and the challenge that I'm facing, is that accountability seems to become some kind of a conspiracy. If you touch certain things or start asking certain questions, the smear campaigns start. But luckily, and I've said this to Alec before, when certain people attack you, you know you're on the right track. So when someone of a certain nature criticizes you, then you should actually see it as encouragement to keep going. Now, over the past 2 years, I've raised questions regarding General Khan. You would have heard of him in the Madlanga Commission, Lieutenant General Mboto, General Teo, General Fani. He was suspended again this week for the second time in a month. General Moodley and several other senior officers. And almost every time I either get legal threats, I get an ethics complaint or two or three, maybe four against me at Parliament. And then a nice prominent smear campaign of some sort also starts. And I guess it comes with the territory, even though it doesn't feel that great during those times. Now, why do I mention these names? So Khan remains particularly relevant. Repeatedly spoken about him, and you would remember he was actually arrested in May for a precious metals case and then released on bail. Now, it's interesting that he has still not been suspended. And, you know, we're not saying that precautionary suspension is an admission of guilt or finding of guilt, but he's obviously, you know, entitled to defend himself, and the evidence must ultimately determine the outcome. But suspension in circumstances involving senior police members, even more so in crime intelligence, you know, such an official is actually protected by that suspension, and it also protects the institution. It allows due process to run its course, and it also ensures that the necessary authority of that office is not threatened in the same way. Now, earlier this year, we went further with these types of cases, and we actually exposed information concerning SAPS members that are involved in the taxi industry. In the Western Cape alone, we had 20 of them that were criminally charged for lying about owning taxis. In fact, one guy at Philippi even goes to work in his own taxi. And we had several others that have been dismissed. 20 were charged through the disciplinary regulations, and they are facing what they seem to need to face. But that's a national issue. Now, I reject the idea that asking hard questions like these somehow damages SAPS. Now, I mentioned this with regards to the Khan example and the suspension, or General Fani and the taxis, because often I get the accusation that because you're zooming in on something, it's either factional or you are making the police look bad. We don't have the luxury of trying to do this to make friends. Then you're in the wrong industry. You need to get out. Something strange happens, though, as soon as it gets close to powerful institutions and people, because it's interesting. I had it again this morning in the Police Portfolio Committee, because it's almost as though you immediately get accused of some kind of an agenda. Investigations are suddenly political. You'll see that certain political players are the ones that almost always make certain accusations. Whistleblowers are suddenly factional and don't enjoy the protection that they should. And eventually, the person asking the questions becomes the story rather than the substance of the actual question. And that's important what I said there, is that they try and remove the focus from the merit of what's being discussed, and they rather focus on the individual and try and tarnish that to get away from the relevant answers. Now, the Constitution requires Parliament to maintain oversight over the National Executive and organs of state. And it does not say that oversight stops when the questions become uncomfortable, or that we are just to make friends, as I already said. Nor can oversight begin with a preferred conclusion. And if evidence clears an official, then you need to accept that. But if evidence points towards misconduct by a constable, major general, lieutenant general, the national commissioner, regardless of the rank, it can't be protected just because you're affiliated in the right way with the so-called right person. You know, and this is where the foundations start that I want to run through with you about what do we need to do to fix this. The first foundation is integrity and leadership. The first is an integrity system that's backed by leadership that's stubborn enough to use it. And I literally mean stubborn. Hardgat. Jy moet moeilik wees. Voet neersit. Lifestyle audit, security, vetting, integrity testing cannot remain box-ticking exercises. SAPS's own 2026 performance framework included that. But when you go look at the amount of people in the previous financial year that went through lifestyle audits, only 5 senior officers had lifestyle audits done. Now, you know as well as I do that that cannot give you an accurate picture of what is going on. We need leadership that's prepared to remove people who cannot or should not occupy positions of authority. And I don't mean arbitrary dismissals. It needs to be done within the framework of legislation and regulations. But if serious misconduct is proved, then fire the person. If somebody repeatedly demonstrates through a fair process they cannot perform the job, replace them. You know, I need to be very frank. We need to start, frankly, to fire more, and continue to fire. We need to decisively fire people. We need to stop moving the problem. because it's the same old perpetrators, whether criminal, disciplinary, or just plain useless, that just get moved from one position to another. And good police members would not only benefit from this, they would flourish because they would have an opportunity to do the job that they dream of doing every day. Then we need competence. And here I want to remove or refer back to General Khan again. The second foundation is proper skills, the structural audit beginning at the top. We have 722 brigadiers and generals, as I said, and we need to make sure that every single one of those has a measurable result for the position that they occupy. And then we need to test the incumbent against the specific job. Now, let me give you Khan's example. His career progression was really strange. He went from being a lieutenant colonel, from a captain directly to becoming a full colonel, skipping lieutenant colonel. He went straight from being a full colonel to becoming a major general, skipping the rank of brigadier. Now, you can imagine what that does to morale and how that actually cheapens this foundation of competence that we would like to build. If an officer is excellent, keep that person and use their expertise. If a post does not require a general, then change it. Don't use it just because it's the status quo. And if one structure duplicates the other, cut it, remove it. And if somebody does not have the skills required for a senior position, rank cannot be allowed to disguise that fact. We've got people in ranks that can hardly have a decent conversation, never mind do a specialized or specialist policing task. The third foundation is intelligence-led policing and prosecution-guided investigations. Now, I've biznewsed those terms up. You know, at every biznews conference, we speak about this. And I think it's one of the most critical building blocks. And we start hearing it in the media, but we're not seeing the result yet. But we need intelligence-led policing. If it means we need to fire the whole lot in certain parts of divisions, entire divisions, departments, whether local, provincial, national, that needs to be decided. But that is the only way that we can fix the investigation crisis or the targeting of organized crime specifically. It must be intelligence-led. We need to make sure that an investigation has to be prosecution-guided. We cannot have this process where we have all of these arrests done, and as soon as it goes to court, it falls flat when it comes to prosecution. We need to make sure that a prosecutor and a detective have the same end goal. At the moment, the one tries to fill the court role and the other one empties it. We look at DNA, ballistics, digital evidence, financial investigation. All of that belongs within this space of fixing intelligence-led policing and prosecution-led investigations. And DNA is just one example, but if we can fix that, it's literally the difference between putting child rapists and murderers behind bars or not. There are thousands upon thousands of perpetrators currently out there that just by processing that piece of DNA could be behind bars within a space of days or weeks. The fourth foundation is to share policing capability. Now, you would have heard Jordan say this yesterday about the city of Cape Town that's declared the intergovernmental dispute. Now, Minister Kachalia gave me a call afterwards, and his first words to me was, "I'm not going to comment on your political posturing." And I laughed, and you know, I think about it now, and I said, "Minister, it's not posturing, it's reality. Whether you like it or not, we are going to get investigative powers on a local level to competent local and provincial authorities. We don't have a choice, because at the moment, there's less than a 5% prosecution or successful conviction rate for firearm-related gang offences in Cape Town alone, never mind the other places. 99% of murders are not solved. So we don't have a choice but to do this. We need to make sure that the SAPS Amendment Bill includes this. They've conveniently said that local authorities can do public order policing. But why would they include that and not investigations? It feels to us like they're picking and choosing what suits a certain narrative or what is comfortable to allow to devolve or not. We see with CIRA regulations that they try to further hamper or make private securities work difficult. But on the 30th of June, private security had to step in to assist in hopefully stabilizing the country when there was a risk of unrest. The private sector had three or four times the air capacity, just in terms of helicopters, than what the state had on that day. Now, why would they then make an enemy of the private security industry? Look at firearms, the Firearm Control Amendment Bill, the fact that they still have people trying to push that ridiculous piece of legislation boggles my mind. Police's own data just a few weeks ago showed us that literally 99 out of 100 firearm murders are committed with illicit firearms. But we see that legislation attacks lawfully armed gun owners and not the bad guys. And so the list can go on. The last one, and then we're going to head to our discussion, is the rebuild from the front line and measure outcomes. This is the final foundation, and it's probably the least glamorous. Everything else, we can add a bit of drama and a story, but it's where citizens will actually experience policing. We need functioning police stations, vehicles, detective caseloads, working communication, rape kits, functional IT, etc. But we also need to change what we measure. SAPS produces enormous amounts of information about activity, and I want much more information about the actual outcomes. Knowing how many vehicles a province owns is less useful than knowing how many actually work during a night shift. Arrest numbers mean very little if the docket collapses before prosecution. So we always hear about Operation Shonela. It means zero because more than 90% of those cases are not prosecuted properly. So the perpetrator is just released again. And that's the difference between measuring activity and measuring proper policing. The minister's reset agenda contains some good proposals, integrity testing, etc. But it's not enough if we don't hear about an integrated approach with the MPA, the private sector, community structures, and even more importantly, the expansion of policing power on a local level. Even with all the political will in the world, the police currently cannot win this fight alone. They have to collaborate. I'm going to conclude. These are the five foundations, in my opinion, that we can use for a serious rebuild of SAPS. We can use words like the reset, as the minister speaks of. I've heard of the so-called FBI moment and all of this. There are basic things here that if we do this and we build all of this on integrity, I know we can actually turn it around. The question is, are the people inside happy with the status quo, or do they actually want to turn the tide? And I'm not convinced yet that there are enough people that actually want to turn the tide on the inside. If things don't change, then we're simply going to rearrange the same institution and give the strategy a new name. Every time we see that with every minister, every national commissioner, if nothing changes, nothing changes. I'm going to end up with those five, and then we can chat about the rest. Thank you.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth. A Mauritian trust offers a powerful solution for global estate planning. Invest better with Brenthurst. Start your day a step ahead. BizNews Insider. It delivers the business stories that matter every morning straight to your inbox, sharp, fast, and free. Subscribe now.